This is Ross Heide, and today we're talking about oral history under an umbrella theme, history is a jigsaw puzzle. Most of us are aware that when you want to study any theme, you may want to use more than one book, because each book will give you some perspective on it. You may want to read a background book. You may find it's worthwhile digging out a general history of that region. And then you may even want something from the national perspective. But today we are going to move down into one type of history, besides manuscripts and newspapers and general books and specific books. You have the type of research which is called oral history. Really isn't any new. There was a man named Draper who way back years ago, I guess it was in the early 1800s, went around and interviewed in Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, some of the earliest settlers. He had no tape recorder and he had no shorthand, but he wrote quickly and kept these papers, and they were deposited in the University of Wisconsin in Madison. So valuable were they felt to be that they microfilmed them. And now you can go and study them at major universities. In Berkeley, the University of California has the Draper manuscripts. And I recall my father wanting to be taken over there so he could get those out. And he was astonished to find he was the first one who had checked them out, because there had yet been no one in that region that wanted to dig out and find the treasures that this researcher had done and had made. There was a historian in California in the early years by the name of Bancroft. He had a bookstore and he began to go around and take the histories of early pioneers. He had his people out buying collections. He gave them the order, don't sort out and try to find what you think's valuable, buy the whole thing, send it to us and we'll sort it out. When it came time for him to do something with them, he made an arrangement with the University of California, which gave a set sum for the papers, and that is an independent library within the University of California library system. Has a separate wall, you've got to go into a separate entrance. But that has become, for the Pacific Coast researcher, one of the finest centers, because they have valuable manuscripts going back to the Mexican occupation, the Russian occupation up in Alaska. And in that, of course, the papers, those early transcripts, are thought to be of great value. Now, somebody has impugned the value of oral history and said it is inaccurate. You may be interviewing people years after the events took place. And how can you know if they're really accurate? They may not be at all. And the answer to that is, how do you know that the books that were written are accurate? How do you know how accurate an autobiography is? And of course, that's something that you have to weigh and you have to examine. I need one bit of notes here, so pardon me while I pick it up. Not there, I guess I down over here. Just looking. It's in the back.
On one of the chairs.
Oh, I see. Well, pardon me while I take a stroll. I find great delight in reading evaluations of history, because most people determine that one source or type of material is more valuable than another one, and at times they lampoon or disparage others. And of course, as I shared with you the other day, one of the great historians was very critical about oral history, and she talked about it being the gathering of a lot of unimportant trivia with all the discriminating power of a vacuum cleaner. And yet I thought you might be as amused as I was by some of the comments that were made about some written history and earlier autobiographies. Most of us, for example, have heard about St. Augustine or Augustine. There's a Protestant and a Catholic pronunciation of that. I'm uncertain when I'm talking to a group which one is which. But St. Augustine's Confession is generally thought to be a much admired book. It is one of the immortal books of religious statement, a beautiful piece of art, but it does it tell us what we really want to know about St. Augustine? And does St. Augustine, though obviously a man of great rectitude, tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about himself? And then they point out one little section that most of us who read it will remember in passing. He relates at one point how as a young man he repulsed and abandoned his mistress, keeping for himself and depriving her of their child. It was St. Augustine's, it was not hers. And how the poor girl wept bitterly and swore to God that she would never let another man touch her. He gives this occurrence, which was a brief episode to him, but was a terrible disaster to the poor girl, about three lines. That is, he glosses over it. A representative of oral history would have wrung from him a little more of the facts about that occurrence, I should think. Now, that's one of the roles of a person who's taking oral history. A person is supposed to be at least aware enough about the general life and activities of this woman or man, so that as they interview them, they let that person give their flow of information. But perhaps once in a while they ask a leading question that will probe over into something that's being passed over too quickly. Or perhaps they will catch a signal by the interviewer's tone of voice that what they're saying is there's something here if you want to dig a little bit. And if you ask a couple questions, you might get more information. I did share with you that this is a fairly recent thing, this matter of oral history, that it was really about the time it began to flourish when tape recorders were available. I shared with you that Alan Nevins was a pioneer. I came across some really interesting things. Most of us know that every enterprise finally has to raise money, and if they can't raise money, they'll die. Now, when Alan Nevins and the group at Columbia University was starting their oral history work, they had to get a little money. I told you they got a small amount from a will and a legacy to Columbia by Frederick Bancroft. Well, that's just a statement, but it was interesting to read Alan Nevins' report of how they got that gift for Columbia. Because most of us have been involved in fundraising, if it's our own church, or if you're like my wife, involved with a literacy council, you've got to try to get some money to do the work of literacy. If you're a volunteer with a hospital, you've got to get some money to do what you want to with a hospital. He shares this about the man, Frederick Bancroft. He had been a librarian of the State Department, and he had written valuable books of history. He had, more importantly, been the brother of a widower who was treasurer of the International Harvester Company. And the brother died while Frederick Bancroft was still very much alive, leaving his entire estate to Frederick. Frederick Bancroft grew old. He knew many of us at Columbia, for he had taken his doctoral degree there. Now, here you have this drama. Alan Nevins, a historian, here's a very wealthy graduate of the university, and you know what has to be done. They've got to cultivate his interest and maintain his interest so that he isn't lured off to leave this money, because apparently he has no heirs. He doesn't want it to go somewhere else. And I was really amused to read this, and I'll share it with you. I often went down to see him at Washington. He would talk about what he intended to do with the $2 million he possessed. In the days of Franklin Roosevelt, he enjoyed pointing to the White House and saying, "My income is larger than that man." Well, as he talked about what he intended to do with those $2 million, we made a few suggestions, which always centered around Columbia University. I would take him to dinner or go to dinner at his house. He would chill my blood by saying, "I'm thinking now of giving the $2 million to the Lowell Foundation for the Lowell Lectureships in Boston." With chilled blood, I would then call my friend Henry Commager and say, "Henry, go take Mr. Bancroft out to dinner and make some suggestions to counter this Lowell Foundation offer." Can't you get this? See it? Here are these people really competing for who would be written in the will of this very, very wealthy man. When I presently went to Washington again, he would say, "Oh, I've been thinking more about where I will leave my money. It occurs to me that Knox College in Illinois would be a very good place." You're just playing with him, you know. My blood would run cold again until I would get Commager or someone else to take him to dinner once more. Well, he finally did die, and we found that the $2 million had been left to Columbia for the advancement of historical studies. Now, pity poor Allen Nevins. He had cultivated this $2 million legacy. Did he get much of it? Read it and weep. I had some ideas about how to use the $2 million, and one was instituting our oral history office. But we also always found it necessary to earn our own way to a great extent. Columbia possessed itself of these $2 million and let us have only a tiny fraction of them. And we needed an annual budget of $36,000 or $40,000 a year. We had to scratch for money. Now, I share this with you because I want you to face the fact that if anyone is going to gather material by going around discovering people that have stories worth recording, there's certain basic expenses in it. You've got travel, you have housing. Unless you find a person who's independently wealthy or at least willing to live on a retirement income, you're going to have a hard time finding somebody to do it. So they have to have a passion, they have to have a commitment to it. I found it interesting to read again what the qualities of an interviewer should be. He said in Allen Nevins' comments, "It's hard to define the best interviewer. He must have a combination of the traits of personality and of intellect that's hard to obtain. First, he must have what the Germans call Gemütlichkeit, obvious sympathy with the person whom he interviews, friendliness and tact, as well as courage. He must work hard to prepare himself for every interview, and he must have a great breadth of interests, not often the possession of the candidate for the PhD, such candidates as appear in our universities." I think what he's twitting them there is that often a PhD becomes a person very narrow in their focus and not broad in their awareness of a lot of other topics, and yet you have to have this sensitivity to a wide range of things so that you really catch the dimensions of a person's life, especially if they've been outside. And then there has to be an element of integrity in the recording of it. You have to be aware if the person is getting sarcastic or ironic and not lose the implication of that. This is one of the portions that I found extremely interesting as I was reviewing again the matter of how you take oral history and what the goal ought to be. I thought I'd be very specific and tell you what you would find if you would read one of the books like Willa Baum's book on transcribing and editing oral history. It was interesting, one of the men that just left on the bus had been somewhat stimulated by the two talks of the last 2 days, and he's going to go back and he's going to encourage his church to invest in a small camcorder and video every baptism and every wedding and the family reunions that are part of it. Now that's one type of oral history, a specific event. But now let's talk about interviewing one of you who's had some really interesting experiences. Ev and I, 2 years ago, were up in Kodiak, Alaska. And while we were there, we went out to the west end of the island. And these people out there, most of them are teachers in the island, and they have homes out at a big bay, Alga Bay, at the west end. And there they have the right to put out nets and catch salmon certain seasons, limited times they're allowed to do it. But while we were there, we were taken on out to an old cannery that's no longer being used, and there were two of the most interesting men I had ever met. These were famous old Kodiak bear hunting guides. And Ev and I got a chance to meet them and listen to them and get the feel of that rugged area out there where these massive bears are and where they would take wealthy people out to hunt so that they could get a trophy. But that person, if you were going to interview, you would want to become aware of some of the material, and then you would want to get as much as you could from them of stories. Now, the basic things that Willebaum points out is that if you're going to be involved in oral history, you have to select your subject, and that means your person often, and then you have to decide, are you going to use a cassette recorder or are you going to try to use videotape? There's some simple mechanical things. You better be sure you have enough tape. You better be sure your equipment's working. You better test it out. And if possible, you might have someone do that while you handle the interview. Next thing is you must know your person. You must do your research. It's really foolish. You feel like you have egg on the face when you realize that you were unaware of a very interesting chapter before perhaps that segment of their life you wanted to investigate. And so if you haven't done thorough research, your oral history might not be as fruitful as it might be otherwise. And that really means that you may want to get in touch with some of the people that know that individual. If they've done any reading, you better read their books. If they've taught, you want to find out the discipline they were in. Find out the highlights of their life. You're smart if you know something about their family. Who doesn't like to talk about their family, and what grandparent isn't willing to show you children's pictures and grandchildren? So you want to treat them as people. Then you make your recording. You record the information. You gather it. And as you do, there are certain little helps. You know that recorders have counters on them. And if I can, when I'm making a recorder with just one person, I try to have the recorder where I can quietly keep an eye on those counters. And periodically, as the counters move on up, I just note down those numbers and then the subject that's being talked about. So that later on, if I have to reflect and go back to that, I don't have to check through the whole thing. I know at what point to go. The biggest difficulty about an oral history interview is that then the material has to be transcribed. You have to type it out. I've done it first on a typewriter, and now, by the grace of God and the Macintosh computer, I can put it on computer. That's very helpful when the next stage comes along. But you do that. Now, I recall getting one valuable interview and then staying home all day and spending 14 hours on a Sunday to transcribe one very important interview. Why do you do that? Well, there's this anthology on oral history has quite a lot of space in one of the chapters there on whether historians will want to hear the recordings or will want to read the transcription. And they pointed out that if you do not hear the person speaking, you miss the animation and the tone of voice. A person gets excited and their voice goes up. Or else, if they're spoofing, they'll use a little inflection in the way they're speaking, and you miss that if you're reading words. On the other hand, it's terribly time-consuming to have to listen to a whole tape to find something when you really want one section. So the transcription will be sought after by most researchers. but some will want to hear the recordings. The next thing you do is give that back. Send it to the person. You make an arrangement. Now, we're not going to use this until you've had a chance to read the transcription and check what you've said, and if you want to modify it, then you may. And I've done this a number of times with people, and I've sent it to them. The most amazing recording I ever took was Robert Marshall, former president of the Lutheran Church in America. I recorded him in 1983 at the World Council of Churches Assembly. We sat together out on the lawn after a coffee break. It's hard to get hold of people. You grab them when you can. We sat there in the sunshine. I had fresh batteries, and I got what turned out later to be about 5 pages of single-space copy. You know, when he got his transcript, there were only 2 slight modifications he wanted, and they probably were my typo errors or a misspelling of a word. That man's mind was so marvelous that he just gave it in the fashion he wanted it. He was that organized and that capable. Others have had to make quite a number of modifications. They felt that it didn't state the way they felt about something. So you send that to them. You get the edited transcript back, and that's where you thank God for computer, because you just scroll through the screen, you take the section there where there's a change, you slip it in, you remove the other, and then you tell it to print, and you've got it done. So that saves hours. And so if you're involved within this, you're very, very glad. There's one other step. You send the corrected transcription back to the interviewee and ask them to sign a release form. This is a very simple document, but it's very important to have, because if this is going to be available for researchers, they're going to give their copyright to the group that made the recording. And so they sign this release. They have the option of putting restrictions. They have the right of putting limitations on who may use it for publication, because they might not trust some researchers or authors. They might put a time limit on it. Are you aware that they made a massive oral history collection of Lutheran leaders a few years ago? They went to all the presidents of the Lutheran churches and many of the leaders who had been in executive positions, and they took oral histories from them. Oral histories that have been bound and are maybe, some of them are at least half this big. 8.5 by 11 paper, one side. And some of the top officials put a restriction down, and some of them said, may not be used until 2005. They wanted some of the people to be dead that they had been critical of. And they didn't want to be open to the criticism. They had felt that there had been unwise things done by these people, and they wanted to say so. But they didn't want to have their comments made public, and yet they wanted to get it into the record. So you get the release sometimes with restrictions. You then have the choice of where shall this be placed. And most of them will be placed in some official archives where they're going to be cared for and available later. Let me make one little comment. It's important, they say, that every cassette that you have should be put through a recorder and fast-forwarded and back each year, and that's to just keep it from deterioration, so that it's safe. And I know one collection in Pacific Lutheran University that has several hundred interviews of Scandinavian immigrants. And every year, one of the staff person goes through that drawer and takes each one out and does this just to protect it. Then you must let it be known that it's available. And then at times the archivist will do some work assisting researchers. Now, I'd like to make a comment about the value of it. Some of the people who had resented oral history really were critical of it as a means of gathering history. Barbara Tuchman was one of those, and she was not very favorable toward this whole discipline. But Alan Nevins pointed out that among the 9 first major interviews they made of public figures that they could point within a decade to 9 doctoral theses that had been written from the material in those oral histories, because there was material there that was nowhere else available. And so it was found to be very, very valuable. I was amused, and I'd like to share with you one of the comments about one of the first ones that they interviewed, Judge Learned Hand. He felt that he wasn't the kind of person that he would like to have been. And he said about himself at one point, his outspoken comment, his salty wit, made his original recollections remarkable. One or two sentences may be recalled. He revered Judge Brandeis, Supreme Court judge. He really held him up like a god. And he said good things about him. He said, I often scolded myself when I was a young man. You eat too much, I told myself. You drink too much. Your thoughts about women are not of the most elevated character. Why can't you be like that great man Brandeis, who does nothing but read interstate commerce reports? He thought he never did anything human. And I thought that was a delightful thing. And so you have the dilemma of working with people who themselves are at times worried about their own ability to do things and whether or not they have the qualities that even should be interviewed. I thought you might enjoy a little look at a person that we have interviewed and a research project that's underway. I'll give you just a bit of history about it. You're going to see here something from the Hawaiian Islands. Have any of you ever been over there to Hawaii? How many has been to Hawaii? Have you been to Lahui, the Garden Isle? Have you ever visited the old Lutheran church, Lahui Lutheran Church?
Yes.
Well, some of you may know that there was a great tragedy a few years ago, and the hurricane blew that church off its foundations. Completely destroyed it. And I thought you might enjoy just seeing a bit of this. You're going to see first a shot of the destroyed church, and then the person whom we're interviewing is shown as the church met in the Sunday school room on the following Sunday, and the television news cameras came there to photograph that. So Evie will let us take a peek at that, and you'll get a little case study on a project that we have underway.
This was the oldest Lutheran church in Hawaii. It still is. The church building, built in 1831, was destroyed by Hurricane Eva. But this Sunday morning, Reverend Edward Spirer held services as usual. The congregation moved into the Sunday school building.
Call that the Church of All Nations.
This congregation was begun by a tiny group of people. I don't think they ever intended this church to remain for 100 years. They thought that it would phase out. But don't you believe it. We didn't lose our church. We only lost our building. We had a painting in our church. The painting showed definitely Peter accepting the command of Jesus when he said, you step out of the boat, come on toward me, just keep your eyes on me. And for the moment, Peter looked around and saw the turmoil and all of the heavy waves, the storm, just like we were frightened, you know, just here a few days ago. And Jesus held out his hands toward him That picture is intact, with the exception of right here in the palm of his left hand is a tiny little tear. It's indicative of another tear, a tear that because he suffered it to be so, brings salvation to all mankind. Until a few days ago, we had a steeple up there, and I have had a tremendous dislike for it, primarily because it's not a copy of the original, that the Lord would give you an answer to my prayer.
Reverend Edward Sparer is 87 years old. He says he'll probably have to live to be 100 to see the church totally rebuilt. He plans to do exactly that. Don Baker, KGMB News, Lehui, Kauai.
Yeah, I guess that was it. Okay, what do you think of that? That was 87. Yeah, 3 years ago. How helpful is it to see and hear Eddie Spire?
Wonderful.
Okay. Tell me what you think about Eddie Spire. What's he look like? Does he look like a Norwegian?
He looks pretty good for 87.
You're evading my question. I love you for that. What's he look like? He looks Jewish. He grew up as an Orthodox Jew in Wilmington, Delaware. His family was strongly Orthodox, and the book that we're writing will tell the story of the way in which he happened to be working on a project and was working with the secretary, who was an active Christian Lutheran, and invited him to church. And he tells about the terrible fear he had as he went to the church one night. And he was afraid somebody would see him from the synagogue. And well, the whole long story is one of the most interesting ones I know. But after having a Bible in the house and a service book from the Lutheran church, his father finally said, his father would find a book and hide it. And Eddie would find a book to read, and then the father would find it again, and it kept going on. Finally, his father blew up, and he said, "Edward, if you don't stop reading that foolishness, you're going to have to get out." And Eddie said, "I'll leave tomorrow." And he did. The next day he packed while his mother cried, and then Eddie took a train from Wilmington, Delaware to Philadelphia to Chicago, all the way to Los Angeles. And there he started his life. His dad was a contractor, and he had studied architecture. And it's a very fascinating story as he gets a job as a carpenter, and then later begins to design houses, and then becomes very sick. For 3 years, he suffered from severe kidney failure and swelling and bloating and great pain. And then finally someone said to him, "Eddie, why don't you promise the Lord you'll serve him? Maybe he'll heal you." And Eddie said, "What could I do for him?" He said, "You can tell others about Jesus." And so Eddie said, "I will." So the next day the doctor came in and he says, "I'm going to be healed. I promised the Lord I'm going to serve him." And he got well. And then instead of preparing to tell the story, he took another job and he got sick again. Well, then he renewed his promise, and it's a fascinating story. He went back to seminary in Fremont, Nebraska, and then he came out to California. He surveyed a community in North Hollywood. He gathered enough people, rented a room, started a Sunday school in the church. He gathered used lumber and built the church with his own hands. St. Matthew's in North Hollywood. It grew and flourished. And then the synod president looked at him and said, "You are good at building. We got a lot of mission churches that crowded in little tiny churches. Why don't you go and help them?" So he went down the Pacific Beach and helped Quint Garman's church improve their facility and add on to it and put a little steeple on so it looked less like a radio repair shack, and which it was, and a little more like a church. He went out to another one, and then finally he was asked to leave the church and come and be director of church extension. And the end of it is that Eddie Speier built 57 mission churches. And then he retired at about 68, and he was supplying a church out in the San Fernando Valley. And the congregation in over in Lihue, he was 80 years old by this time, heard that he had a certain gift, and they asked him to come out and be their minister. "I don't want to go out there. I'm happy where I am." And they kept after him. So finally he went out to Lihue in the island of Kauai. And he looked at it, and he didn't think he wanted to do that. He felt too old. So he came back home and wrote to him and says, "No, I don't think I could come. You get a younger man. It's got more needs than I can give you." And they kept after him. And finally he went to the synod president. He says, "These people won't let me go. I don't want to go out there." And then Lloyd Burke says, "Well, we'll pay your way out. Go on out and visit them and see what you think." If you wonder how I know all this, I sat with Eddie Speier for 5 hours and took his oral history from his childhood days up till the day we were talking. And he went out and visited him, and he still wasn't that enamored about it. And finally he said, they came to him and said, "We have a woman out here that's been outside of the church, hasn't come for a while. Why don't you go call on her?" So Eddie said, "All right, I'll go visit her." So Eddie was a tremendous Bible believer, and he, on the way out, he said, "Lord, if this woman responds, I'll think about coming here." And so he went to this house, and she wouldn't even let him in the door. But he stayed there talking courteous and friendly and humorous and persistently, and a little girl came and stood right by the woman and listened to them, and then she looked up and says, "Mama, who is that nice man?" And the woman melted, and she promised she'd come back to church next Sunday. And as they drove back, Eddie said, "Lord, I asked for one person, and you gave me two. I'll come." So he came, and this old church was in lousy shape. It was in very poor condition. They completely renovated it. And this is a picture of the inside of that church when it was rededicated after he had rebuilt it just from neglect. And then it was about 3 years later, the hurricane hit it. And at the middle of the night, Eddie was in the parsonage next door and he heard this terrific crash. And Eddie got up and put his robe on, took a flashlight, and he went out the parsonage door and he turned to the right and he held it up, and there was a ruin. The roof had been blown over and the cemetery stones and the walls had come down and everything had tumbled in. And Eddie said, "Oh Lord, help me get it back up again." Now the announcer in the television says that Eddie said it'll be 3 years before they get it done. 11 months to the day they dedicated that rebuilt church. And it's built stronger than it ever had been. And then he stayed there for a couple more years. And then he moved back to California. Now he's retired and living in Carlsbad by the Sea. And he's the chaplain for the home where he is. One of my friends was down and visited him the other day and says, "Eddie is leading service every day. And he's chipper." And he's now, I guess, 93, isn't he? But to me, that man's life story has to be written. So that's one of my next projects. And that's Eddie Speier. I only use this as a case study. I wanted you to see the way in which When you're aware of a person and a topic that needs to be reported, no one had ever written a book about Eddie, but there are magazine articles about him, and I've got copies of those. He made the cover of the Lutheran magazine 3 times, showed him work in coveralls, you know, building, carpentering, building church, or laying a cornerstone. And then I got the other material. I wrote here and there. I contacted other people. And I have all the research material and a lot of pictures. So that's one of the next things. Now, I only share this with you because I thought you might find it interesting to sense how you use oral history as one part of research in a book. Now, let's pause. And what would you like to ask about this? What have I left unsaid?
You got one point that I would be interested in. How did he relate with his family after he left?
It's typically Orthodox. His mother was heartbroken, but his father was very angry. And of course, the Orthodox has very strong action they take. If a person leaves the Orthodox Jewish faith, it is a custom in many of the synagogues that they have a funeral service. And Eddie was in Los Angeles, and some months later, as he is walking along the street in Los Angeles, here coming toward him was a high school classmate of his in Navy uniform, and he was out there in the Navy, and he had a little day off, and he was here, and he looked at Eddie, and Eddie told me he stopped and his mouth fell open and he said, "Eddie, I thought you were dead. I heard they had your funeral." And he says, "Well, I'm not." But that's the answer to that question. Now, his father, tragically, a number of weeks after Eddie went west, was on a contracting job. And he was in one of the upper floors of a building, and he was going to use a freight elevator. And there had been some mistake in the use of this elevator. And he stepped on the elevator, but unfortunately it was 3 floors down. And Eddie's father was killed in this fall. But he kept in touch with his mother. And about 4 years later, when he was in seminary back in Fremont, I found an article in one of their newspapers that Eddie Speier, on the New Year's holiday break, went back to Maryland to visit his family. So he did have a reunion with them and a sister and a brother. But you have touched upon one of the unfortunate dimensions of a person moving from one faith to another. Any other question?
Did you say you interviewed him at length?
Yes, I went down to Carlsbad, and my wife had a convention or a conference to go to in Lake Arrowhead, and while she was in that, I just drove down and spent a day and a half down there, and I had a lot of fun with Eddie. I kept a few tapes filling up, and I transcribed all of them.
Well, I think that's what lots of times has made history so dull, is they've taken out all the human interest.
You're right.
And that's what makes this so interesting. You could go and hear him preach and maybe know a little bit about his background, but when you actually get the whole human interest story, it's a tremendous thing that touches people.
Thank you. I think that's very well said. Luther said too many preachers don't hang apples on the trees. They don't use illustrations enough. And of course, human interest stories just come out naturally in this. I'll share some of those in the future days. I have in the other tape there, and the one we put on, you might put it on and just for fun, see if the other one. The other tape is one that Eddie gave me from the television station in Lihue, which are film clips during the hurricane. And I was really stunned to watch it. And This one that we had, I had put in the wrong box, apparently. But I thought that you might find it interesting to have a chance, and it must be on the other tape that you have it. While she's putting it in, oh, it'll come on now. Let's check it out.
It still is. The church building, built in 1831, was destroyed by Hurricane Eva. But this Sunday morning, Reverend Edward Spirer held services as usual.
And we'll go through
this. Congregation moved into the Sunday school building.
After that, Ev, I think they go into the other.
From the pile of rubble left behind by Eva. The church had just completed a costly 5-year restoration project when she hit, and ironically, the new rebuilding program is scheduled to be finished around the first anniversary of Eva's attack.
The actual building is somewhere in the neighborhood of about $315,000. The lit glass windows, we figure, will cost about $40,000 to replace.
The Huey's downtown business district has been put back together physically, but for some, the cash registers still aren't bringing up the sales they were before EVA. How much is business down?
About 35% down.
Some businesses, however, were able to bounce right back with new customers brought in for the rebuilding job.
We had another factor affecting our business is the contractors being over here. They've been purchasing fuel.
The hurricane has made Kauai more image conscious. Almost everyone who's in the public eye wears a Kauai Loves You button, a campaign undertaken to bring back the tourists.
The one thing that's growing, and it's showing some comment from our visitors who come here, that they see the old Kauai Aloha. I think the when you are doing real well and no effort is necessary, you start getting a little arrogant. And I think this is God's way of knocking some arrogance out of you know, the people. And I would say that in all respect, we've come out ahead.
And indeed, Kunimura's attitude appears to prevail. The newfound concern will surely help Kauai's recovery. And if it's a lasting change, it will also help the island's future. Tomorrow, a look at Kauai's tourist industry. Okay. Kelly Dean, KITV 4 News on Kauai.
You can see if I would just take out that one clip of the rebuilding and then put some other in there, we can utilize this for a little video history of the congregation over there at Lahui. Any closing questions before we wrap up? It's been good to be able to be with you, and we'll pick this up again from another facet of history, and congregational history, I think, is the topic they've asked me to work on tomorrow. Is it tomorrow evening? Thank you for coming. Back to the sunshine.